Thank you very much for having me here. So, what I had in mind for showing you is the following outline. I would like to start with a small introduction into accelerating models and hopefully motivate for you why it's worthwhile to study infrared modifications of GR. And then I will discuss a little bit some of the screening mechanisms which you need in this infrared modifications of GR in order to recover GR on small scales. And then I will very quickly concentrate on a very important class of infrared modifications of GR, so massive gravity, and then illustrate to you the very elaborate theory of DRGT theory. But we will not spend so much time in the full theory, but rather study a given limit of it, the decoupling limit of massive of the DRGT theory, and study the cosmology there. And from the decoupling limit, I will construct the proxy theory to the DRGT theory and study the cosmology there as well, and then compare the results. And finally, I will discuss the quantum consistency of the DRGT theory and conclude. So I hope you're happy with the outline. You can complain now or be silent. So, as you know, the universe is accelerating, and we have no idea what is. Why it is accelerating. So there are different models trying to explain this expansion of the universe. So for instance, it could be due to a cosmological constant, but then we have to explain why is it so small. So we have to deal with the cosmological constant problem. Or it could be due to some sort of a dynamical fluid scalar field causing this expansion. There we might have similar fine-tuning problems. Or it could be due to some modifications of GR, so modifying Einstein's equations. And there the question is, of course, is there any viable model? And I will be concentrating on massive gravity. So let me try to give you a few motivations why we should study infrared modifications of GR. As I already said in the previous slide, it gives a very nice alternative to the cosmological constant or dark energy in order to explain the accelerated expansion of the universe. Maybe a more important motivation is it gives also a way of attacking the cosmological constant problem. So trying to explain the giant mismatch between the physical observed value and the theoretically guessed value. And of course, it is just fair to have an alternative model to which we can compare GR and test the both theories against each other. So when we say GR is doing an amazing well job, of course, we would like to know, is there another model which maybe does an amazing job? And of course, you learn more about GR by modifying it, and maybe it's fun. So I hope I give you enough motivations why we should study infrared modifications of GR. So yeah, let's modify GR. But let's not get too excited and exaggerated. So we want to modifications only close to the horizon scale, around 1 gigaparsec. So on small scales, on solar system scales, we want to recover GR. Okay, so as you know, modifying GR means that you end up typically with new degrees of freedom, usually in form of a scalar field given by this general Lagrangian. And now you have to find mechanisms to hide this extra degree of freedom on small scales, where GR makes an amazing job. And there are two important categories to do this. So there is the density-dependent mass category, where the chameleon is the important screening mechanism, where the mass of this scalar field depends on the environment. And then there is the density-dependent coupling category, where the Weinstein mechanism and the symmetry mechanism are the important representatives. In the case of the Weinstein mechanism, it is this derivative nonlinear interaction of the scalar field, which depends on the environment. And in the case of the symmetron, there is one person in the audience who knows better than me, the coupling to the matter field, which depends then on the environment. So let's have a quick look how these mechanisms work. So as I said, in the case of the Weinstein mechanism, which is at work in massive gravity and in Galileans, it is this nonlinear derivative interactions which play a crucial role. So this effective coupling to the matter fields depend on the self-interactions of the scalar field once you properly canonically normalize the field. So when you canonically normalize the field, then the coupling to the matter field gets redressed. And if the nonlinear interactions are large, then the coupling to the matter fields becomes small. So there will be a regime, there will be a radius, the Weinstein radius, within which this nonlinear interaction will become important, such that the coupling to the matter field will be weak, and outside the Weinstein radius, these interactions will become will stop dominating, and then you recover, you see the effect of the scalar field. Yeah. So in the case of massive gravity, this scalar field is part of the massive graviton. It's really a part of the graviton itself. While in the case of the Galileans, it's a scalar field you add on top of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So in the case of massive gravity, this scalar field is the helicity 0 degree of freedom of the massive graviton, and it's tightly related to the graviton itself. While in the Galilean scenario, it's a scalar field you add on top of the usual GR. There are some common features between those fields, but there are also differences, which I will show. Okay, in the case of the chameleon mechanism, which is not used in massive gravity or Galilean kind of theories, there are two important ingredients. So there is this conformal coupling to the scalar, to the matter fields, between the scalar field and the matter fields, and the scalar field has a potential. And now, because of this extra conformal coupling to the matter fields, once you compute the equations of motion, what you see is you end up with an effective potential which depends on the density of the environment. So you obtain an effective potential which depends on the density of environment, and now you can make the mass of the scalar field large or small depending on which density regime you are. So if you are in a higher density regime, you can make the mass large, and if you are in a less dense regime, make the mass small and screen the degree of freedom. In the case of the symmetry mechanism, you have also these two important ingredients, even though the physical way how the mechanism works is different. So you have, again, the potential term for the scalar field and then this conformal coupling to the matter fields. But now you have a very, very specific symmetry breaking potential of this form and the conformal coupling to the matter fields given by this form. And again, when you compute the equations of motion, you obtain an effective potential which depends on the density. But now if this term dominates, if the densities are high, then the field sits in a minimum here at the origin. And since the perturbations couple to the matter fields in this very specific way, so they couple like that, in this high density regime, the coupling becomes zero. So you screen the scalar field, you don't see its effect. And when the local density drops, and then this field will either jump into one of these new minimums, and then you now gain an effective coupling to the matter fields. So the coupling depends on the environment.
So you're modifying gravity by changing the coupling term. You introduce the scalar field in the coupling constant.
So
between matter and gravity.
So like, yeah. So what I am introducing here is a scalar field on top of the Einstein-Hilbert action with this, and this is now your metric in the Jordan frame, so to which your matter fields couple.
So my question is that why this has the IR features of GR? So how is it related to the IR infrared features of gravity?
Oh, so yeah. So if you want to do now cosmology with this, you want this guy to be very small mass. So it's in the case of the Galilean or massive gravity, these scalar fields are usually light. And in the case of the chameleon and symmetron, in the case of the symmetron is as well light. So you want to see the effect on large scales. But in the case of the chameleon, you say, okay, on large scales, this guy has a small mass. So So you see, it's a fact, but on large on objects which are dense, this guy becomes massive, so you don't see its effect. So there is this extra degree of freedom which you put by hand, let's say.
And so why this would be more natural than the fine-tuning of the cosmological constant?
I didn't say that it would be more natural. Sure. Not yet.
But this is you're presenting as an alternative, or someone presented as an alternative.
Yeah, so here I have to correct then myself if I gave the impression.
I think the main argument was that it's more fun than the cosmological. That was the last one.
In the case of massive gravity, so when I gave this in the introduction, I wanted to really concentrate on massive gravity and just wanted to give you some screening mechanism which are out there. But for the massive gravity, it's really the Weinstein mechanism and not this extra, this color fields you just put by hand. Okay, yeah, let's concentrate on massive gravity. As I said, it's one of the most natural ways to modify gravity in the infrared by giving them the graviton a mass. And so, as you know, in GR, gravity has an infinite range, but now if you give a mass to the graviton, it will shut down at a given distance, and it will weaken at large distances. So how do you make a graviton massive? So you write a mass term for the graviton in this form. So you add a linear mass term. You write down all the possible contractions you can think of, with arbitrary coefficients first a priori, and but the only Gauss-free version of this mass term would be the Fields-Pauli tuning, in which these coefficients need to be chosen in this way, such that you don't have the Gauss. So some degrees of freedom, which are maybe negative kinetic term and are not bounded from below, and so on. And now, if you are too happy and take this this theory too seriously and compute some graviton exchange amplitudes between two objects, let's say Earth and Moon or whatever, or Sun and Earth, then when you compute a graviton exchange amplitude, what you find is this VdVz discontinuity, just because you have this extra degree of freedom. So you see its effect there. But as we discussed before, you will now anticipate and say, okay, but wait a minute, this is just the linear part of the theory. So you need all the nonlinear interactions of the scalar field such that it will be then screened out on the small scale scales. Okay, so the VdVz discontinuity is just an artifact of the linear approximation. So you need to find the nonlinear extension. But the problem is that the Gauss, which we have cured by tuning these coefficients M1 and M2 in a specific way, comes back when you add this nonlinear interactions. And it was a challenging task for almost 40 years to find this nonlinear extension without giving a Gauss. And only recently, in 2010, yeah, I hope they're not mad that I'm showing this kind of pictures of them. So Deram, Gavaretz, and Tolley, they found this nonlinear extension in which there is no Gauss whatsoever. So they tuned all the parameters of these nonlinear interactions such that the Gauss was disappeared. And now you would say, okay, now I have the Weinstein mechanism at work, right? Because now I managed to find the nonlinear interaction and the Weinstein mechanism will be at work. So you have now this all these nonlinear interactions of the scalar field, which are large on small scales, such that this scalar field will be then screened. So you don't see its effect. So how does this theory look like? So it has a very complicated structure. So on top of the Einstein-Hilbert term, you have now this potential term. And this potential interaction is given by this very specific form, where this covariant tensor H is given by that. So it has this Stückelberg fields. And the potential terms need to have this very specific structure, where this K matrix is given by that. So it has this square root structure here in it. And the coefficients here, the sign and the coefficients here are very important in order not to have the ghost problem. So this pi here has this helicity 2 field, the scalar field appearing here is just a shortcut for partial nu pi. So it comes here in the interactions. And here we have neglected the helicity 1 part because in the decoupling limit, it will not play any role. So as I said, let's jump to the decoupling limit of the mass of gravity theory. So how do you construct the decoupling limit? So you construct it by taking the Planck mass to infinity to graviton mass to 0 while keeping the scale constant. So the decoupling limit corresponds to the limit in which all the momenta are much larger than the mass of the graviton, such that you can describe all the degrees of freedom by its helicity. So since it is a spin, massive spin 2 field, you will have 2 helicity 2, 2 helicity 1, and 1 helicity 0 field. And here we will neglect the helicity 1 field. So when you take this limit in this complicated theory, then the theory becomes very, very easy. It just has this structure now here. So it has the usual kinetic term for the helicity 2 field, and then this very specific interaction between helicity 2 and the helicity 0 field. So this matrix X encodes the derivative interactions of the pi field. And it has this very specific interaction form with anti-symmetric tensors appearing in them, which will be crucial for us. And when you maybe stare long enough to the interactions, you will recognize that they have very similar structure as the Galilean interactions. So instead of the H here, in the case of the Galileans, you have a pi. So yeah, this is the decoupling limit of massive gravity. You just have interactions between the helicity 2 and helicity 0 fields. And you can go to the Einstein frame. You can diagonalize these interactions by performing this change of variables. And what you obtain is, as I said, the usual kinetic term for the helicity 2 field. And then you obtain these Galilean interactions. But one crucial important difference is you cannot diagonalize this third interaction. So it's still there. You cannot find a way of changing this variable to diagonalize also this term. And also you obtain an additional coupling to the stress energy tensor. So in the case of the Galileans, it is just the pi t coupling. But in the case of massive gravity, you also have this derivative coupling, which will also have crucial differences in observations or whatsoever. So let me just emphasize here the differences and the common points between Galileans and massive gravity. So as I already said, both are infrared modifications of gravity due to a light scalar field with nonlinear derivative interactions. So the Weinstein mechanism will be at work. They respect the symmetry, the shift and Galilean symmetry, and they give rise only to second-order equations of motion, so you don't have any instability issue. And for both, the normalization theorem applies, which we'll also shortly discuss. The differences, as I said, there is this third interaction, which is there, which is different from the Galilean interactions, which turns out to be important for some for obtaining self-accelerating solution. And then there is this extra coupling, which is also not there in the Galilean theory. Yes?
So you mentioned that because you have second order equations, you know you have no instability issues. Are you sure about that? I mean, one can write theories that have second order derivatives and there will be instability.
Well, there won't be any instabilities related to, you know, this Bolvier-Desert Gauss kind of instabilities. So you would really have just the degrees of freedom which corresponds to your physical degrees of freedom. But it could be that on some given background, I don't know, spherical symmetric background or cosmological background, that some of these physical degrees of freedom have some pathologies. That's for sure, yeah. And actually, we will do that. So we will try to find some self-accelerating solutions in which we will constrain the parameters such we don't have other instabilities. And the theory has only 2 free parameters in the case of massive gravity. And as I said, there will be observational differences due to that and here.
So how many parameters does the Galilean have?
So it has only two free parameters. Sorry that I forgot to mention.
So both of them have two free parameters? Or?
So this has just two free parameters. In the case of the Galileans, it's three.
But the mass is also another free parameter.
But it's not independent. It's like an overall factor which multiplies alpha 3 and alpha 4.
You have a background metric as well. That's a free matrix.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you have the
so we went from 1 to over 10.
Yeah, if you want to say that, see it like that.
Why do you say I'm not?
So,
I mean, you always have a background metric as a free number.
No.
So here, in the case of master gravity.
Are you talking about, because this is the biometric theory, is that what you're saying?
Right, so I have to define it somehow.
So in the case of master gravity, you remember the way how we constructed the mass term here?
Yeah.
You could think that, I don't know, how can I give a mass term to the graviton? I could write G mean U squared or things like that, but there's no way that you can really use your metric to write down. So you need a fixed background on top of which you can then define your mass of graviton. Here we have just flat background metric, which we assumed so far.
Right, this is background metric, that's right.
Yeah. So yeah, the in this sense it's maybe less nice than GR in the sense that it depends on the background you are choosing. I agree.
But just like a string theory, I guess that also depends on the background.
So okay, we will try to use this decoupling limit to find some self-accelerating solution. And we will be interested in the self-accelerating solution. There are also degravitating solutions, which I will not concentrate in this talk. So we will assume that there is no cosmological constant, so T min is equal to zero, and then see if we can use this extra degree of freedom, this scalar field, in order to give rise to self-accelerating solution.
Can I then ask you about what you're not talking about? You're saying there are degravitating solutions? So what do they do exactly?
So in the case of the degravitating solution, you assume that there is a large cosmological constant,
yeah.
Then you use the helicity zero as a condensate mm-hmm. to compensate the energy coming from the cosmological constant.
Okay.
Or in other words, since you have massive gravity, the large scale sources are weakened. So the gravity is weak.
So I remember there was this issue that then you, somehow Einstein didn't work in that theory, or is that...
Yeah, so the reason why I don't concentrate here is you can find the gravitating solution and then you can try to screen a large cosmological constant, but then if you want to be also in agreement with solar system tests or if you want the Weinstein mechanism to be at work, then there's a conflict. So the larger the cosmological constant, the shorter you push the Weinstein radius. So the equations of motion for the helicity 2 field and then the helicity 0 field. As I said, we will be interested in the self-accelerating solution and in which this guy is not 0. So we will solve this in brackets being 0, put it back here, and then solve the self-acceleration. So we were able to find self-accelerating solution in which the Hubble parameter is proportional to the mass of the graviton. So you already see, in order to have a variable self-accelerating solution, you need the mass of the graviton to be of the order of the Hubble parameter. And we studied its stability. So in order to have stable self-accelerating solutions, your parameters have to fulfill these constraints. Otherwise, we have other instabilities. And there you see, this third interaction, which was not diagonalizable, plays a crucial role, because if it wasn't there, then you couldn't fulfill this constraint, and then you would have some instabilities. And there's another important crucial point is that there is no quadratic mixing term between the perturbations of the helicity 2 field and the helicity 0 field. And since the matter field is coupled to the helicity 2 field, and since there is no mixing between them, you can, the perturbations of Telesity 2 field, zero field, do not couple to the matter field. It means that on top of the self-accelerating background, the perturbations of the Telesity 0 field do not couple to the matter field, meaning that you really have a cosmological evolution which is completely the same as Lambda CDM. So you have a boring cosmological evolution in the sense. So you cannot go and try to study perturbations.
But you don't have any matter here, so how do you know that? I mean, it seems that this is just pure a vacuum solution.
So this H minu, T minu, imagine T minu is some astrophysical object, some galaxies or stars, whatever. These perturbations of the Telesity zero field will not couple to them. So you don't actually need, on top of the self-accelerating background, you don't need any Weinstein mechanism.
But my point is that you don't exactly live at this limit where H and H is constant, right? I mean, matter is comparable to...
Sure, yeah. This solution we find here in the decoupling limit is only on scales below Hubble scale. So if you want to go beyond that, this solution will not apply.
Because if when you talk about acceleration of the universe, you're talking about cosmological scale. So how can you, on one hand, talk about self-acceleration, and on the other hand, talk about the scale, well, non-cosmological scale? Acceleration is a cosmological phenomenon. Right?
Yes.
So you need to solve Weissmann equations or the field equations on cosmological scale.
Sure, right? That's what we were doing. That's what we were doing. But I'm just saying that. Now, on top of this background, if you look at the perturbations coming from this extra degree of freedom are decoupled. You don't feel them.
But your background is a pure Desiter background now?
Yeah, exactly.
So saying, yeah, if it's not pure Desiter, then what you're saying may not, because I mean, we don't live in a pure Desiter.
Yeah, so here it's pure Desiter. So your H is like a small perturbations around Minkowski. Yeah, in this decoupling limit, so the self-accelerating solution. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just for pure Desiter.
So you're just talking about the small perturbations of Minkowski.
Okay, so.
How is Desiter a small perturbation about Minkowski?
It's just an approximation you do. You say your H minu is a small perturbation causing the Desiter.
Yeah, locally.
Is locally. So there are also full FRW solutions to the DRGT theory, which I am not discussing here. But yeah, people have already also studied those solutions. This is just an approximated solution to give a feeling.
But I think your last statement is a very strong statement. You say cosmological evolution is very similar, or I guess they don't very similar, do you mean exactly the same amount?
Yeah, I'm saying here in the approximation we made,
okay.
The solution, the self-accelerating solution we find, is exactly the same as in the Lambda CDM because we don't see the effects, the perturbative effects of the extra degree of freedom. But of course, beyond the approximation we are using, we will see all the effects coming from massive gravity. It will have effect on structure formation, on all the other observational probes. Yeah. Okay, so now we will try to construct a proxy theory to the RGT, starting from the decoupling limit. So this was our decoupling limit Lagrangian. Now let's focus on the first interaction between the H and pi, which is given by that. So H mu nu box pi eta mu nu minus partial nu pi. Now we can do integrations by part and see it gives this kind of interactions, which are actually just R times pi kind of coupling if you take the weak field limit. So when you covariantize the first interaction, you get this kind of non-minimal couplings. And when you do the same thing for the second and third interaction, you will obtain this other kind of non-minimal coupling between the pi field and the graviton. So there is this derivative interactions with the Einstein tensor. And then the third interaction corresponding to the derivative interaction to the dual Riemann tensor, where the dual Riemann tensor is given by that with very specific coefficients as well.
Can you remind us what capital pi was? Pi alpha
beta. Yeah, this is just partial mu partial alpha partial beta pi.
Oh.
It's just a shortcut for two derivatives applying on the pi field. So from the decoupling limit of massive gravity, you can construct this kind of non-minimal interactions between the scalar field and the graviton.
Is this the same as von Weske?
Yeah, yeah. This is a subclass of von Weske theory. But the difference here is we constructed it from purely massive gravity kind of sense. Yeah. But yeah, it's a subclass of von Weske theories. So since Gemini and the Stuart-Riemann tensor are the only divergence with tensors, the equations of motions are second order. You don't have any of these instabilities. And of course, it reproduces the decoupling limit because we constructed it from there. So the Weinstein mechanism will be at work. And there again, we can play the same rule, study some approximations, look if we find a similar approximated self-accelerating solutions as we found in the decoupling limit. And we were able to find, so in which again, the Hubble parameter is proportional to the graviton. Well, it's not a graviton mass anymore. It's in this theory, in this proxy theory, to the parameter m. So we were able to find similar results as in the decoupling limit. And we have also studied the perturbations here and put some constraints on the parameters A2 and A3. And they were relying in the same parameter space as in the decoupling limit. Okay, so the way how this extra, the density corresponding to the pi field behaves is the following. During the radiation domination, the energy density for the pi goes as 8 to minus 1 half, during matter as 8 to minus 3 half, and during lead time as a constant. So at early times when the interactions are, large, the interactions for the scalar field pi are important, so you will have some sort of a cosmological screening mechanism. So at early times, when the density rho radiation or rho matter is large enough, the densities, the self-interactions of the pi field are important, and therefore the scalar field is screened. Only when the densities drop sufficiently, you see the effect coming from this scalar field. And since the perturbations of this scalar field in the proxy theory do not decouple, you will see have some differences than to the usual lambda CDM cosmological evolution. Okay, so far so good. Now, yeah.
There are only two parameter systems, right?
Sure.
So
the same as?
The same as?
As in massive gravity, the decoupling limit of massive gravity, we had two free parameters. From the decoupling limit interactions, we constructed by covariantizing this proxy theory. So it has also these two three parameters.
But then again, this is self-accelerating, so you don't want to have lambda. You want to take away lambda, but then add these two parameters instead, and then get self-acceleration, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now you have these two free parameters, which
are... So we looked at whether this is consistent with cosmological and the probes of acceleration, like is that W naught and WA and things like that. Is it because expansion history is very close to lambda CDM as far as we know, right? So do you get similar expansion history?
Yeah, so here you get similar expansion history in the approximation we did. So this is like a analytical solution to this proxy theory. So we made this ansatz and we considered regime in which h pi is much smaller than pi dot. And This is the analytical solution to the proxy theory, the self-accelerating solution, in which now these parameters A2 and A3 plays the role of the cosmological constant,
but
let's say.
No, I guess the important part is that as matter decreases, how do you approach this? Like, for example, DGP also has self-accelerating solution. Of course, that has other problems, but that is ruled out just because it doesn't approach lambda CDM or lambda fast enough. That's kind of more gradual than more gradual. It essentially has a W effective of minus one there.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question is, what is the effective W for?
Yeah, here in this approximated with it is exactly the same as for cosmological constant. But of course, you need to take this theory and solve the equations numerically, mm-hmm. and then see if there is really a nice way of going from radiation domination to matter domination and then to cosmological constant, which hasn't been done yet. So, but yeah, it should be done. Which,
so I have a question about this early screen epoch.
Yeah.
Is there an understanding of how the perturbations in the pi field itself behave during that screen epoch?
You mean
it? So what's the statement is that it doesn't couple the matter, but independently of matter, is it understood how that field is evolving during that epoch of radiation domination?
Yeah. So this is like the way how you would expect it to behave, like from a theoretical point of view. But it's very hard to really implement this in your, you know, numerical calculation and see how the Weinstein mechanism really works. So there, it hasn't been studied in more detail than that what I am saying here. Yeah. So you really need to know how the Weinstein mechanism really works at this large densities, and because this pi field has this nonlinear interactions, all these nonlinearities are very complicated to deal with numerically. Are there other questions? If not, then let's maybe go further and then ask if this theory is consistent at the quantum level. So, as I said, the mass of the graviton needs to be tuned to a very small value. So it needs to be small. And as I already said, these coefficients in front of the H, for instance, need to be tuned. And the question now we want to ask is, does the small mass of the graviton receive large quantum corrections? And the tuning of these parameters change under quantum corrections, or if the theory is stable under quantum corrections. So let's first have a look to the quantum corrections in the decoupling limit. So in the decoupling limit, our theory was given by that. So we would like to know if these parameters A2 and A3 and the mass of the graviton is stable under quantum corrections. As I already said, the mass needs to be tuned, so it's a very small mass. The tuning is as worse as the cosmological constants, let's say. But the difference is that the mass of the graviton is expected to remain small under quantum corrections. So we will try to show that the quantum corrections themselves will be proportional to the mass of the graviton. So they will be small quantum corrections. So therefore, even the theory is tuned, it will be technically natural. So there will be tuning, but not fine tuning. For that, let's remind ourselves what the tough naturalness argument was about. So the tough naturalness argument says that if you have any physical parameter at energy scale, at any arbitrary energy scale, then if you take this parameter limit going zero, if this is increases the symmetry, then this parameter is technically natural. So in the case of mass of gravity, the parameter here, the mass of the graviton, if you take the limit m going zero limit, if this increases the symmetry, then it will protect you against quantum corrections.
Is it about global symmetry? No, I don't think there's any argument about gauge symmetry, right? In your case, you're talking about gauge symmetry, right? The mass is zero, what you're adding is the next by gauge symmetry.
The tough naturalness argument, it works also for, you know, the massive photon, for any kind of massive massive particles.
Why wouldn't it work for gauge symmetry?
It's usually very different. You have a dynamical field and it can be strongly coupled. Let's say, look at Ojava gravity. Mm. So there, it seems that people have done computation that, you know, you break the local Lorentz symmetry, and it turns out that it's a breaking which is
but here we
enhanced by the normalization. So
yeah, but here I'm saying, okay, we have the general covariance for GR, and we are breaking it but by this small parameter. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking when you take the m going zero limit, you recover the...
Yeah, a full gauge symmetry. So this is, that's what I'm saying, what you're recovering is, it's not just a global symmetry, it's a full gauge symmetry.
I think that for Java Lipschitz, this also works. The problem is you don't approach Lorentz invariants fast enough. So if you want to go from order one violation to other constraints.
I thought it was not stable on the ontology.
Yeah, I think you're right. Just saying gauge invariants is not enough because the QED in two dimensions, for example, mm-hmm. the photon gets a mass, even though it's gauge invariant, it gets a gauge invariant mass. So there's an additional argument you need that the you don't get. The infrared divergences you need to actually generate a mass in four dimensions, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but are you concluding?
That in four dimensions, it's okay to say this, but generally, you need a little bit more. You need to argue that there's no
anomaly.
It's related, but it's just that you can get a gauge invariant mass if there's the right poles.
I see. Yeah, in our case, we would have the right dimension, let's say, in which if you have the gauge symmetry, then you really have just this physical degrees of freedom, which propagate. Yeah. Okay. Let's give an example, like the electron mass is way smaller than the electroweak scale, but this mass is technically natural, so there is no really quantum corrections, large quantum corrections on top of the electron mass. It gives quantum corrections only proportional to the mass of the electron itself. And when you take the mass going zero limit, you have this additional chiral symmetry, which protects you against quantum corrections. But in the case of the cosmological constant, there is no symmetry recovered in the lambda going zero limit. And of course, any particle, any mass, massive particle of mass m will contribute to the vacuum energy.
So you're not solving that problem, right?
No. So I wished I could.
Well, that was kind of the promise of the massive gravity program, right? The beginning.
Yes.
It's still a program.
So I didn't, maybe there's, we can discuss later, but maybe there is a way out to find a gravitating solution which is not in conflict with Weinstein mechanism, and so on. So there is the tuning versus fine tuning. So as I said, the mass of the graviton needs to be tuned, but there is no fine tuning. So the Toff naturalness argument applies, and in the massless limit, we recover symmetry which protects from large quantum corrections, and in the full theory, beyond this mass going zero limit, the quantum corrections need to be then proportional to the mass of the graviton itself, such that when you take the limit, m going to zero limit, there won't be any quantum corrections. Okay, maybe some of you are not convinced about the Toff naturalness argument.
Well, it's just that if you have a gauge symmetry, you have to be careful that not only you have the mass parameter, but you have an infinite volume of the gauge symmetry that are going to multiply your evaluation.
I see.
So unless you know, otherwise it would be great, but you know, people,
if you
can write gravity as a topological field theory, but but the problem is usually that.
I see.
That it's a very different regime, right? To have m different from zero, m equal to zero, there's an infinite number of new degrees of freedom which are now pure gauge, so which are now appears as volumes. So they tend to multiply your amplitude in some uncontrollable way.
Can't you argue? I mean, you know that within pure GR, there's no graviton mass that gets generated. It's just
because you divide out by this.
But that's just a physical fact about GR.
Yeah.
So it must be that when you have this small mass, things are proportional to it.
No, because people in numerical simulation, that's a big problem.
You have a lot more than just a mass. I mean, you've endowed it with a psychometric. I mean, I'm not sure if you can say
that. You have an infinite number of new degrees of freedom that you have to show are quenched in this way. So this is the problem. What happened to this infinite? You know,
The thing is, you just conjecture that they're all quenched, and that's
exactly. So, or that they decouple. But usually, the problem is that they have a tendency, And then, you know, to be strongly coupled, unless you do some.
But I mean, it's not
that's what the Weinstein thing.
But the Weinstein.
I mean, strongly coupled doesn't. It could be decoupled and strongly coupled at the same time. So that's.
I mean, numerical simulation, people, you know, are facing that. Which is,
I mean, from the numerical point of view, even if it's hard from a physical point of view, even if this infinite number degrees of freedom. Yeah. Even if they strongly couple within themselves, they will decouple from the rest, and you should recover the GR result where you know that there is no quantum corrections whatsoever.
Why should they decouple? That's the thing. You want to...
Unless
you have usually they decouple by extreme fine tuning.
Well, I think that's what the Weinstein argument is supposed to tell you. That in fact, the physical limit of this theory is smooth to that of GR.
That's a classical argument. The problem is that, you know, at the quantum level, the RG flow, the thing is that you have this strong coupling and no fine tuning. You're talking about the RG flow.
Uh-huh.
So the problem is whether the RG flow is going to take this infinite reservoir degrees of freedom and then pop it up into the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Maybe at some level, it's just a crap. I mean, we don't know quantum gravity, so it's an event like
that.
No,
but you can do one loop or two loop, you know.
But I will try to argue. I will try to argue that even at the at the quantum level, not only at the classical level, the same remains. So the Weinstein mechanism will be also work at the quantum level, and then make that these degrees of freedom are actually not very are harmless or decoupled. Or
so has anyone shown that the Weinstein mechanism actually works in the dynamical setting? When I look at the equations, this is like I've talked with our people in the building several times. They are nasty,
that's right. I think there have been a couple of works where they tried to solve even just the Earth with Moon, which is like you would say the simplest, the realistic thing.
Naive. I mean, they actually, by some fear, they have made assumptions that get rid of the problematic current. So to me, they haven't looked at the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But Matt was trying to solve it, and what happened?
So leave it to the other person in the building who's referring to.
So the answer is that, no, not that.
Work in progress.
So here we all assume that we have, you know, nice static, no time dependence, Weinstein mechanism, and so on. Yeah, there's a bunch of complications, sure. Okay, so I will try to show that in the decoupling limit, there is no quantum corrections due to non-normalization theorem. So there will be no large quantum corrections to the mass of the graviton, and also there won't be any tuning of the coefficients in the decoupling limit. And then later on, we will see how it goes beyond the decoupling limit. So in order to see that, let's have a look how the non-normalization theorem works in the Galilean theory. So as I said, the Galilean interactions, they have this form with this very specific antisymmetric tensor appearing there. And now the counter terms arising in one loop effective action coming from this kind of Galilean interactions, they come with at least one extra derivative as compared to the original Galilean interactions. So they will not take the Galilean interactions at all. So these parameters for the Galilean interactions, they can be technically naturally tuned to any value, and then they stay stable under quantum corrections. So how does the non-normalization theorem works? Let's have a look at least to the cubic Galilean. This is our cubic Galilean. And we can look at an arbitrary vertex where this interaction will be applying. So we have an external pi field coming in, which can be contracted with this pi field at this vertex, and these two pi fields running in the loops, the external particle with the momentum q mu and the internal ones with k mu and k mu plus q mu. And then when you compute the contribution from this kind of vertex with the Galilean interaction to the transition amplitude, what you obtain is this. So this amplitude, this contribution to the amplitude has this antisymmetric tensor in it again. And when you look at this carefully, you will see that all the terms which are linear or independent of Q, they will disappear because this guy is antisymmetric. So if you have K alpha, K beta, Q rho, K sigma, this will disappear. and also the ones where Q doesn't come in, so K alpha, K beta, K rho, K sigma, because of this anti-symmetric structure, they will disappear. And the only contribution which will survive this are the ones which come in with at least two more derivatives applying on the external particle. So at any loop that involves this kind of cubic Galilean vertex will give rise at least two more derivatives on the external leg. So you construct terms out of loops which are, which do not have the original Galilean interactions. So they are protected by other, under quantum corrections. And the same thing applies for the rest of the Galilean interactions, not only for the cubic. And exactly the same thing happens for the decoupling limit of massive gravity. So instead of the pi, we have now h, so to say. So we can again contract an external h with this guy and then let the pi fields run in the loop and compute the contribution. Yeah?
So I don't quite understand the diagram. The big pi is involving two derivatives of the little pi. So why do I only have to consider one momentum k there? Why isn't there two powers of momentum?
There is. Here, you know, these are the two momentums coming from the, so the, this is the pi alpha beta, which is k alpha k beta. Okay, so now this was just in the decoupling limit. So we have seen that in the decoupling limit, the normalization theorem protects the original interactions, getting large quantum corrections. Now beyond the decoupling limit, let's have a look how the quantum corrections contribute. So our action is given by that, right? We have the massive graviton with the potential, and then we also consider covariant coupling to the matter fields. So the difference to the usual GR is our propagator has now this mass in it appearing, and instead of 1/2, we have here a 1/3. And we just, for simplicity, considered for the matter fields just the massive scalar field to which the gravity couples. And at one loop level in this toy model with the scalar field being the matter field, there is only either graviton loops or matter loops. So there is no mixing simultaneous running of the gravitons and matters in the same loop. And only at higher loops, the mixing will be important and has to be taken into account. So you can perform the calculation in your favorite method. So you can compute them perturbatively by Feynman diagrams, compute each Feynman diagram, add them together and see what contribution you get. Or you can perform the calculation at the one loop effective action level. It doesn't matter which method you use, you obtain the same result. So at one loop, when the matter fields run in the loop, they are unaware of the graviton mass, which is here on the external particle. So therefore, the only covariant contribution that they can give rise is in form of a cosmological constant. So exactly in the same way as in GR, you expect this kind of one-loop quantum corrections to give cosmological constant. So you find your less favorite grad student and let them compete or whatever. So we competed all these diagrams at one-loop level. And what we indeed found was just a contribution in form of a cosmological constant. So we were only interested in graviton loops changing the potential. So we were not interested in kinetic term kind of change. And so as I said, they give rise only to a cosmological constant, but leaves the potential interactions unchanged. And you can do the same thing with the one loop effective action, and which we did, and we find the same result. The story is a little bit different when you consider the one loop gravitons. So the one loop corrections to the mass, to the potential of the graviton, is not, the nice structure is not conserved by this kind of graviton loops. So there is a detuning of the parameters. And for instance, if you just look at the two-point function, so it gives you terms in this form with the wrong coefficients. And when you write them in terms of the LSD2 guy, which has higher derivative now and corresponding to a ghost, and if you see at which in scale these interactions come, then you see that there will be around Planck mass, so they are harmless. But when you go to higher endpoint function, so when you obtain this kind of contributions with the wrong coefficients, giving rise to this kind of higher derivatives for the pi field, now if you are far away in space where this guy is very small, the ghost, the mass corresponding to the ghost would be still around Planck scale, Planck mass. Only if you argue that you are maybe close to some objects where this guy might become large, then you can actually push the mass of the ghost to lower scale. So if this was the end of the story, this would be really bad, since on very large background pi fields, you would actually push the ghost mass to smaller and smaller scales. But this is only at the level of the operators. So you need to build in this large background also to the two-point function, to the whole effective action, the one-loop effective action. And what you actually find is that they resum into a way that even if this guy is very large, at the level of the one-loop effective action, the ghost appears at a scale which is never smaller than the Planck scale.
So if you just power count the Galilean effective field theory, you would think that the ghost should come in at lambda 3 at the cutoff of the effective field theory. How is it being pushed all the way to the Planck mass?
How it's pushed to the Planck mass?
Yeah, I would have thought that it comes in generically at the cutoff of the effective field theory, which would be lambda 3.
So, I mean, in the case of the mass of gravity, your cutoff is not lambda, right? It's the rescaled cutoff.
Yeah, but before any of the redressing or anything, let's just look around a flat background, so if there's no issue with the redressing, then I would think lambda 3 should be the cutoff. And so the ghost should come in at lambda 3.
But are those two the same statements? If there's a cutoff at lambda 3, that doesn't mean that there's a ghost at lambda 3.
I think generically it is, because if I look at the higher derivative terms that are in the Galilean action, which are not second order, those will be suppressed by lambda 3, so the generic scale of the mass of the ghost should be lambda 3.
Yeah, maybe it's different in the case of mass of gravity. I don't know. But
it is a Galilean
kind of thing.
So if you go to the next slide, I just wanted to. So the statement is that this is the one-loop effective action.
Yes. So the way how then this large background comes in the one-loop effective action, even if this guy is very large, then the scale at which these interactions will be important is still around the Planck mass. So
in a sense, it looks like that the lambda does play a role there. Kind of the perturbation theory breaks down around lambda. But I mean,
well, you make this whole thing large,
right?
If this guy is large, since it's 1 over,
yeah.
you can neglect it.
Right, but it seems that there are two different statements. One is when you get ghosts, you agree that the gradient expansion breaks down when that d squared phi naught becomes the order of lambda cube. In a sense that if you want to Taylor expand that Taylor expansion divergent. So that's one statement. And another is whether there is a ghost. So your claim is there is no ghost until you
Yeah, in the rough estimation we do, there is the mass of the ghost only appears at the around Planck. Yeah, that's the way how it comes in it at the level of the effective action. Individually, it's really hard to see, but somehow there is some in a form that, yeah, it's basically. Yeah, maybe we can discuss later. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, and also there will be, of course, some impact of massive gravity on cosmological observations. So you will have, as we were saying, the geometrical probe. So at the background level, the measurement of the Hubble function. So by measuring the distance redshift relations of supernovae or using CMB or baryon acoustic oscillations. And then once you fix your parameters using these probes, you can then go one step further and look at structure formation probes, for instance, homogeneous growth of the cosmic structure, so just the linear growth, where you still don't have all this Weinstein mechanism issues, and then go to the nonlinear growth, steady Lansing, or how the galaxies are formed, etc. And then put your constraints on the parameters coming from there. And if these both parameter constraints do not agree, well, that's too bad for you. So then let me conclude. So we have discussed the decoupling limit of the RGT theory and discussed some stable self-acceleration solution, which were similar to the lambda CDM. From the decoupling limit, we have constructed a proxy theory and studied there also stable self-excitating solution. And there, the scalar mode did not decouple around this self-excitating background and gave rise to an extra force during history of the universe. So there will be differences in the cosmological evolution. It would be, for instance, influence the time sequence of gravitational clustering or the evolution of peculiar velocities and so on. And we have also looked at the quantum corrections and saw that in the decoupling limit, there is this non-normalization theorem which protects the interactions from quantum corrections. And beyond the decoupling limit, the effect of the external matter loops is harmless, is in the same way as in GR, and gives only rise to a cosmological constant. And nevertheless, the one-loop graviton contribution between the structure of the potential, but the mass of the ghost appearing is never below the Planck scale. That's it. More questions? So,
yeah, maybe we have time for a few questions.
I'm a bit puzzled about when you talk about mass of the ghost, because the Lagrangian you wrote down didn't seem to have a mass, it was a massless.
Well, it's the scale at which this interaction would come in. When I say
okay. So I mean, how do you define that exactly?
So this is like the mass term, right? In the
not in terms of pi, but in terms of h, you say.
Yeah, here when I say the mass of the ghost, I mean like the scale at which this interaction would come in. Originally, it was coming from the mass term, but this thing would be not the mass term. This would be like a higher potential for the h. But in terms of the pi, you would then see at which scale this interaction then would come in.
That's not a Galilean interaction. That's a higher derivative interaction. So it's propagating more than one degree of freedom.
And exactly.
And that second degree of freedom is going to have a mass of whatever is suppressing the scale there.
I don't understand how, in what sense it's a mass, because I mean, this is a shift symmetry. So
it's a single field with a higher derivative Lagrangian. So I can take that and rewrite it in terms of two fields that are in second order. And one of those fields you'll find has a mass that's the same scale that's suppressing that higher order interaction.
Yeah. That's right. So this other extra ghost degree of freedom is hiding himself beyond this higher derivative interactions.
questions. All right, let's start the meeting again.
Thank you.